Good afternoon, Regent Radio. This is Omi Salma Rahimtullah, and I am joined on the line by Dr. Gerald Horn. Hello, Dr. Horn. How are you?
Oh, fine. I'd like to flip the script for this program, which is being taped on Thursday. Evening for Saturday broadcast, because there are tumultuous events in Pakistan as we speak that have a Toronto angle.
Yes.
That I understand you have intimate knowledge about these events.
Well, not intimate, but I would say that the person in question is Mohammed Tahir Ul Qadri, who is actually a dual citizenship, so Pakistani-Canadian. Apparently he lived in Toronto for 8 years. My friend's parents know him, and he was quite the well-known fellow, I guess, here in Toronto. But he has just returned to Pakistan about a month ago and is now leading this kind of Pakistani-style Million Man March. So he's mobilizing people around a discourse, I guess, of Tahrir Square. My friend was saying, oh, it's even so coincidental that his name is Tahrir, and that he's trying to kind of use this discourse of Tahrir Square to mobilize a bunch of people around him. A lot of people are, a lot of Pakistanis, I think, even in Canada, are hesitant of this movement. But he's demanding things that otherwise we would, see maybe as progressive. The dissolution of the Election Commission, to ensure that candidates standing for elections pay tax. He's also called on the dissolving of the assemblies and the formation of a caretaker government. So, in that sense, it's very, very extreme, but he seems to have mobilized people around him, not in the millions, but in the hundreds of thousands. So, but people are also critical of him just kind of helicoptering in, right? Having lived in Canada for so long, being a dual citizenship, and then just coming in and, sparking up this movement has also got people uneasy.
What I understand about him is that he is Sufi, number one, which I find striking given the level of sectarianism in Pakistan, because as you know, in recent weeks in Pakistan, there have been murderous attacks on non-Sunni Muslims, particularly Shia Muslims. Secondly, is that he appears to have some sort of relationship with the military, which is curious. As a matter of fact, the press reports that I've been reading suggest that he might even be some sort of front man for the military. Also, what's interesting is that his massive mobilization in Pakistan is dovetailing with a parallel move by the High Court in Pakistan to dislodge the government by having the prime minister detained. So he obviously has some high-level contacts, which makes it all the more curious that he's a dual national of both Canada and Pakistan, and B, the fact that he has, as you put it, helicoptered in. You wonder, was he in contact with the military before he came in? Is it a coincidence that he just comes in as the High Court moves against the civilian government, which, by the way, this government was about to finish its elected term, which would have been a first in Pakistan history, because previous prime ministers, they've been murdered, such as with Benazir Bhutto, or they've been detained, they've been thrown out of office, they've been subjected to military coups. And it was thought that this government would finally break that unfortunate pattern. But now, with the arrival of your homeboy from Toronto, it doesn't seem like it's going to happen.
I mean, I think it's definite that he had connections, with the army or with other parts of the government because of the way. Some reports are saying he's been in Pakistan only a month and he's already been a week or almost a week within this movement that has garnered, nonetheless, some support, right? So it's definitely fishy, and I think time will reveal maybe more of his connections.
I understand also that he's quite adept in the law, that he studied the law.
Yep.
Apparently I understand also that within the Pakistani context, he seems to be somewhat progressive on questions of women's rights. I don't know if that would be true of the Canadian context.
I don't know too much about the women's rights, but he was a professor at the University of Pakistan in law. In the University of Punjab in law.
Other critics, at least on this side of the Atlantic, feel that he's a bit wacky, although I wouldn't put that adjective or that label on him.
I mean, that is one of the words that are going around. I too would be hesitant to call someone wacky, but it's like I was saying, my friend, you know, knows of him in an intimate way, like as in like, oh yeah, I remember when he lived in Toronto kind of thing. And, you know, people were hesitant. I think the word is hesitant that I will use. go ahead.
Well, can I shift gears?
I'd like to ask you about the
indigenous protests in Canada, which I understand are gaining even more momentum than it did the last time we talked.
That's exactly where I wanted to go as well. So, the Idle No More is definitely picking up momentum. There's a call for January 28th to be marked the World Day of Action. So Idle No More solidarity rallies all over the world. But we've seen, even in the past couple of weeks, we've seen rallies in India. We've seen rallies, in parts of Latin America. So it really has picked up some international steam. But there is also, a bit of contestation within the quote-unquote movement. A press release being released 2 days ago, I believe, where the four women who started the movement were saying that, we need to discuss this issue of violence, and violence is not something that they would resort to or not something that's part of the Idle No More, movement's principles. And, of course, I think that they were addressing blockades of the border crossings that have gotten a bit quote-unquote violent. And also, there's some issue, and I'm not filling in here. I'm not too aware of what's going on here. I just read about this, that someone has asked the Queen to intervene in Theresa Spence's hunger strike.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know who it would be, but the Queen is not going to intervene. I don't know where that came from.
Not the Governor General, Queen.
The Queen. And I just read this like 5 minutes before I called you, so I can't be too sure. It just came out. But there's also the Idle No More movement, and I heard an interview with one of these. There's these four ladies from Saskatchewan, I think, who started this movement, and they were saying that the elders speak for the movement, that there's no one person. And I think in that sense, they were, taking particular attention to Theresa Spence, saying she doesn't speak for the whole movement, right? This is very much a decentralized movement. There's a lot of action going on. There's a lot of support. But there's also, and not in a negative way, a lot of discussions within the movement as to where is this going, what are its aims, et cetera. Your take on what's going on in Idle No More.
So what's the prognosis then, given what you just said?
I'm not in the business of making prognosis. That's your job.
I see. Well, let's hope that it's positive.
Well, I definitely, that's what I'm saying. Like, even though there's these kinds of issues that are coming up, I don't think that they're in any way negative. Like, I think they're very much displaying the possibilities that can happen within the movement and the stuff that people need to discuss, right? That this needs to be, a space where people can speak about their aims and their ambitions and what they think the movement should be or should not be. So I think that these are definitely also very positive movements.
Oh, very good. Very good.
That's ideal.
Well, let me shift gears and launch a discussion of Northwest Africa.
Let's do it.
As we speak, you may know that there was a hostage crisis in Algeria. Apparently, some militants, insurgents, so-called Islamists in Algeria, in opposition to the French invasion of Mali, seized hostages, U.S. hostages, British hostages, etc. And just before I began to speak with you, I understand that the Algerians had swept in and basically disrupted this hostage crisis by killing a number of the militants And in the process, a number of the hostages also were killed. Now, this has caused consternation in the North Atlantic countries because Britain, for example, felt that it had not been briefed before the Algerians swept in. There have been critics of the Algerians because apparently they didn't have any kind of sophisticated so-called SWAT team or hostage crisis team. They just used their military, which was a blunt instrument in this kind of operation. For their part, Algerians are upset because the Algerians are not necessarily happy with the French military fighting on their southern border, which is what is happening in Mali as we speak. The Algerians did not support the NATO war in Libya in 2011 that led to dislodging of the Gaddafi regime. And in fact, a number of members of the Gaddafi family have taken refuge in Algeria, which is not necessarily please the Libyan nor the U.S. government. It's very curious that this hostage crisis erupted just across the border from Libya and Algerian territory, and indeed, some of the hostage takers were said to have spent quite a bit of time in 2012 in Libya, where, as you know, since the dislodging of the Gaddafi regime, the so-called Islamists have found a haven, which led to the slaying of the U.S. ambassador, Chris Stevens, on September 11, 2012. What's even more curious about these unfolding events in Northwest Africa and in North Africa is that the NATO countries dislodged Colonel Gaddafi, with whom they had been cooperating in an ongoing contestation with these Islamists, but they, that is to say, the NATO countries then turned the tables on Gaddafi by aligning with the Islamists to overthrow Gaddafi, and now they're reaping the whirlwind, because since the last time we spoke, the French intervention in Mali has escalated. Even though we're receiving these rosy stories about how the French are disrupting the supply lines of the so-called Islamists, the fact of the matter is that these conservative religious radicals have had a lot of time to prepare for this French invasion. And my understanding is that they built a very extensive underground network, a network of tunnels through which one can drive vehicles. And that has basically neutralized the French advantage in the air, because it's very difficult for French fighter jets to bomb on the ground what they cannot spot, because the militants are underground. This French intervention, it seems to me, is going to end in tears. It has the potential to be a larger disaster than the Afghan disaster that is unfolding. Of course, there are connections between the two, because the leader of the hostage takers in Algeria had fought alongside the U.S. forces, by the way, in Afghanistan against the Soviets during the 1980s. But what's happening now in Mali is an escalation of an overall crisis. The Economic Community of West African States has been asked to contribute forces, but apparently they're not enthusiastic. Recall that when we've spoken in recent weeks, we had talked about how there had been a resolution by the United Nations Security Council to have the intervention of September 2013. And we recall, we found that very curious, because we're wondering, why are they waiting so long? And now we see why they're waiting so long, because there's no enthusiasm on the part of ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, to get involved in this crisis, which is understandable. Because basically, what's going to happen is that this tension in Mali between Muslims and non-Muslims has the potential to be exported throughout Northern Africa and Northwest Africa. For example, the French fighter jets that are bombing northern Mali or taking off from Chad. The Nigerians are supposed to contribute hundreds of troops, but as we well know, in northern Nigeria, there is a so-called Islamist insurgency led by Boko Haram that is very disruptive. In all of the countries that are supposed to be contributing troops, there are similar sorts of tensions between Muslims and non-Muslims that will be exacerbated if these countries get involved in the Malian crisis. I'm speaking of Senegal, for example, Burkina Faso, Cote d'Ivoire, where, of course, that tension was very strong, even Togo and Benin. So this French intervention, it seems to me, is going to end up being disastrous. What's curious is that Mr. Sarkozy, the former French president, had invaded and had launched and initiated this war against Libya in part to boost his sagging popularity ratings. I think it's fair to say that his successor, Mr. Hollande, has invaded Mali for similar reasons, that is to say his popularity ratings were flagging. But when the body bags of dead French soldiers begin returning to Paris, there is a distinct possibility that the fate of Sarkozy will be the fate of Hollande, that is to say that Mr. Hollande will be driven from office just as surely as Mr. Sarkozy was driven from office. Another interesting aspect of this entire crisis is that, according to the New York Times, the Malian military that overthrew the civilian government in 2012 had been trained by U.S. forces, which is quite striking, I would say. More than that, some of the regiments that had been trained by U.S. forces were the first to defect to the Islamist side, taking their weapons and their military arsenals with them, which now have been turned on the French occupation forces. All in all, this Malian crisis is revealing the folly of the Libyan invasion of 2011, which was the starting point for this crisis. And I must add a further note, what's even curious on this side of the border is that many of our friends on the left basically supported this U.S. and NATO intervention in Libya, believe it or not. And these people who supported this intervention consider themselves to be the most strident opponents of the Obama regime, and yet they supported his most disastrous move, which was launching this war against Libya. Now, figure that out for me if you can.
Well, this is what I wanted to... I won't figure it out for you, I'll tell you from now. But this is what I wanted to ask you then. I know you do not read such things as blogs, but a very popular blog around these days, to inform you, is called Africa's a Country. And it's rather interesting, has a bit of a, you know, popular culture slant, whatever. For the most part, their articles are good, but there was a claim made by Gregory Mann, who is an Africanist, so you might know, that this is not a neo-colonial offensive. And I feel almost absurd asking this question that, I mean, what he's arguing is that, you know, the Malian president asked for this, and so France is just obliging. I mean, I think that's a rather weak argument for at a position for someone who might consider themselves from the left, right? And so it seems to be kind of repeating what you just said about Libya, sorry.
Well, I think you're raising another point, which I've noticed too, is that I think there has been a spectacular failure of many of the specialists. That's to say, those who specialize in the study of Libya, those who specialize in the study of the Maghreb, those who specialize in the study of Mali or Northwest Africa. I think that they have tunnel vision. That is to say, that they are not able to ascertain the second and third order consequences of an immediate action. I think that it would be useful, for example, if they would take up chess, for example, and then they would be able perhaps to plot out moves beyond immediate consequences. I noticed that particularly with regard to Libya, where some of the specialists, and even some of our friends on the left, they were so fixated on Gaddafi and his real and imagined defects that they couldn't see these consequences that we're now seeing in January 2013. That is to say, the spillover into Mali, the spillover into Algeria, the possible spillover into Nigeria. They don't see those things because they specialize in a particular country. Like if they specialize in Libya, well, then they don't necessarily have knowledge of Mali. Well, they don't necessarily have knowledge of Algeria. It reminds me of the study of the United States. You have all of these U.S. historians. I think one quarter of the historians in the world are based in the United States, with many of them studying U.S. history. And what's striking is that few of them study the 200-plus years of U.S. history. They'll study maybe a single year or a single state or a single individual and do that for their entire lives. If what it reminds me of is the Rodney King trial. You remember that trial in Los Angeles?
Yeah, vaguely.
After the black motorist Rodney King was caught on tape being beaten by police officers, and they went to trial, and the police officers were acquitted. And the way the defense lawyers were able to do that, besides the racism of a jury that included no blacks, was that instead of showing the tape of his being beaten continuously, they showed the tape in segments, and they would show a little segment here and say, "Are you seeing anything wrong?" People say, "No." Show a little segment here, you say, "See anything wrong?" And then they would sort of fast forward past the actual beating, and then of course there would be no problem, and then the juries could say, "Well, I didn't see anything wrong. I mean, I just saw, you know, a guy speeding and officers talking to him, etc." In other words, just as the jurors didn't have a comprehensive view of that episode in order to make a finding of guilty of these officers, these analysts don't have a comprehensive view of imperialism. They don't have a comprehensive view of Africa. They know a little bit of the story, such as maybe, you know, Gaddafi, maybe what's going on in Mali. And then they get tripped up. And then it reminds me of the old Cuban saying, which is that it's easier to turn a revolutionary into a technician than to turn a technician into a revolutionary. And many of these people we're talking about, because they don't have a revolutionary outlook with regard to U.S. imperialism, it's difficult for them to take a critical viewpoint of U.S. imperialism. And then again, there's another point too, which is I think a lot of these people, they're very comfortable in the United States. Even though they're upset with some of the symptoms of U.S. imperialism, they're not sufficiently upset to make a frontal challenge. And there you have it in terms of why so many wind up taking incorrect and, in fact, wrong-headed positions on NATO invasion of North African countries.
Thank you for clearing that up. Moving now to Northeast Asia, we haven't really talked about those tensions in a few weeks.
Well, you know, the things haven't abated. Matter of fact, it's very worrisome. I think I've said before that if you want something to have a sleepless night about, think of these tensions between Japan and China over these uninhabited islands. But it's more than that, because China, because of its missteps and misdeeds over the years, has basically helped to alienate many of its neighbors. The Japanese leadership was just in Vietnam over the past week. As you know, in 1979, China invaded Vietnam. Some would say to get on the good side of the United States. China left with a bloody nose. But they did wind up getting on the good side of the United States, which led to massive direct foreign investment into China post-1979, which has helped to build up this gargantuan Chinese economy. Now is rather awesome, in fact. China doesn't have a very good relations with India. You may recall that during the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, the fall of 1962, when the world was on the precipice of nuclear destruction and everybody was focused on missiles in Cuba, China took that opportunity to invade India, which then Prime Minister Nehru almost brought him to tears. I mean, I could go on in this vein. And so China, even though its economy is, quote, booming, unquote, it's managed to alienate many of its neighbors, and it basically suggests that going forward in this century, the road is going to be very rocky, I'm afraid, for Beijing.
And also, in the past couple of weeks, we haven't talked about Afghanistan. And I mean, so much going on. And I know you want to talk about, but I was like, I don't know what he wants to talk about. So take that away, too.
Well, I think the last time we spoke, Mr. Karzai, the leader of Afghanistan, was in Washington.
Yes.
And what was effectuated was this agreement that in 2014, next year, there would be a drawdown of U.S. troops. If I were a betting man, I would say that when U.S. troops begin to leave, that the Karzai regime will be weakened, and there is a distinct possibility that the Taliban will be returning to power. I don't think we should rule that out at all. Even with the U.S. troops there, in the past week or so, there have been a stunning number of attacks by Taliban forces. Within the last 48 hours, there was a massive attack on the intelligence headquarters in Kabul, the capital. Kabul, of course, is the headquarters of the Karzai regime. It was thought that the neighborhood where this attack took place was the most secure in the capital city. Obviously, that's not true. The attacks by Karzai military figures on NATO, particularly U.S. military figures, continues. That is to say, assassination attempts and successful assassinations against U.S. leading military figures continues in Kabul. So this crisis continues, as I said. Even though this intervention in Afghanistan has been one of the major blunders, it seems to me, in NATO's entire history, at the end of the day, what's unfolding in Northwest Africa, believe it or not, may exceed the blunder that we see unfolding in Afghanistan.
And we have a few minutes left, and I was this is off the cuff, and I don't know if you've been following it, but the African Nations Cup has started. I don't know if you're following, if you have anything to say about that.
Well, if history is any guide, I expect the Cameroonians to do quite well. They usually do. Of course, my sentimental favorite in any of the sporting events involving Africa are Southern African nations, since I used to reside in Southern Africa. But
well, Zambia showed the last tournament, Zambia, you know, came out flying, and I think this is the tournament for Southern Africa. So maybe there is some hope there.
Well, let me ask you, who are you putting your money on?
Oh, you know what? I'll be honest. I haven't really been following, but I'm hoping to catch on. But I couldn't say with any certainty. I mean, the only certainty I'd have if Tanzania ever made the tournament, which not happening in my lifetime.
Oh, speaking of Tanzania, remember I asked you about that businesswoman in Tanzania who apparently was beheaded? Did you find out anything about that?
No, I didn't, but I will definitely look it up for next week's show.
Oh, good. And another thing, too, I think the last time we talked, today is January 17th, and supposedly on January 10th, Hugo Chavez was to be sworn in, but of course he didn't show up because he's still recovering from his operation for cancer in Havana, Cuba. The opposition is creating quite a storm and a stir as a result. But since Mr. Chavez has repeatedly been elected and reelected, I think that the opposition, their storm and a stir, might wind up being no more than a tempest in a teapot. And if they're not careful, they might overstep their bounds and may wind up on the wrong side of the law.
And we have 1 minute left, so if there's anything else you wanted to add that we might have missed for this week.
Well, let me mention a U.S. domestic issue, which is this question of guns.
Yes, an Obama speech,
As you know, there's going to be an attempt to curb this proliferation of guns in the United States. There is a country with 300 million people, and there are about 300 million weapons floating around. But what's even more curious is that those 300 million weapons are not evenly distributed. They're mostly in the hands of the right wing. That is to say, they're mostly in the hands of the white right, to put it bluntly. And I think that this is a real challenge because a lot of our friends on the left, they've fallen down on the job in being able to do a political analysis. That is to say, to make an analysis of class forces, race forces, et cetera, and then make a projection politically. Our friends on the left, all they know how to do is say that, you know, Obama's selling us out. I mean, that was the last new idea that they've come up with. And here you have, with this question of guns, they have to confront the white right because it's clear that they're the problem. And so I don't really expect some of our friends on the left to be too vocal about this because it's much too frightening. It's much too intimidating what these people have in store. You know, gun sales are going through the roof. They have ever since November 2008 with the presidential election. Believe it or not, gun sales even skyrocketed further after the Connecticut tragedy. In other words, rather than drawing the lesson from seeing school children being mowed down at their desks, these right-wingers basically took that as an opportunity to up the ante. They started buying even more weapons. And in fact, we're not only talking about assault weapons and AK-47s. Some of these right-wingers, they're buying rocket launchers. They have hand grenades. I mean, you wonder, what are they preparing for? Don't be surprised, and I hope you take me in if I have to scurry across the border.
Well, we'll make space for you definitely north of the border, but hopefully we won't have to. Well, that brings us to the end of our show, and thank you once again for joining us, and we'll definitely be talking to you next week.
I hope so. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.